We would like to acknowledge that the land which we are gathered on today is the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe Nation, specifically the Chippewa Tri-Council, comprised of the Chippewas of Beausoleil, Rama, and Georgina Island First Nations, and more recently, the Mississaugas of the Credit River First Nation. Ontario is covered by 46 treaties and other agreements and is home to many Indigenous nations from across Turtle Island, including the Inuit and the Métis. These treaties and other agreements, including the One Dish with One Spoon Wampum Belt Covenant, are agreements to peaceably share and care for the land and its resources. Other Indigenous nations, Europeans, and newcomers were invited into this covenant in the spirit of respect, peace, and friendship. Most of us have come here as settlers, immigrants, or newcomers in this generation or generations past. We are all treaty people. Every day, we are mindful of broken covenants, and we strive to make this right. We commit to collaborating based on the foundational assumption that Indigenous peoples have their power, strength, and competency to develop culturally specific strategies for their communities. We are dedicated to honoring Indigenous self-determination, history, and culture, and are committed to moving forward in the spirit of reconciliation and respect with all First Nation, Métis, and Inuit people. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Beyond the Stethoscope, a podcast focused on hospice palliative care. My name is Linda Meeks, and I'm one of the education facilitators for the North Simcoe Muskoka Hospice Palliative Care Network. Today, I would like to introduce you to Sherry Hubbard, one of our nurse consultants for the network, and Dr. Julio Didio-Dado. Dr. Julio Didio-Dado is one of the intensivists at the RVH Hospital in Barrie and is also the chief research scientist there. Today, Sherry and Dr. Didio-Dado will be discussing an advanced care planning and communication tool for patients and families to facilitate goals of care discussions. Welcome. Sherry, would you like to continue on with our guest?
I sure will. Thank you so much. It is my absolute pleasure to welcome our guest speaker, Dr. Julio Didio-Dado. I have had the absolute pleasure of working with Julio in the critical care services since 2005. And our team, you know, often has struggled supporting patients and families with some very challenging conversations and decision making. And when we think about end of life issues, it is very difficult. We don't like to think about death of our loved ones or for ourselves. Yet at some point in time, we really do need to start thinking and talking about these very challenging decisions. And inevitably, our bodies age and become more fragile and dependent on others. Even though we know this, in Canada, we seem to be reluctant to have these really great conversations so that patients' families will have an idea of what is okay for them. And advanced care planning means that you have discussions with your family and friends, especially your substitute decision maker, the person who will speak for you if you cannot. It includes decisions about your healthcare providers so that you have an accurate medical information in which to make these decisions. It is best if it's written down so that the team can actually read it. And it's a great way to give your loved ones the confidence to speak for you with these very challenging decisions. Julio, you have been involved in a very interesting advanced care planning tool that you created and have been published on this research tool. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. Good morning, Sherry, and thank you for the invitation. We call it the Goals of Care Advanced Care Planning Tool. We've noticed as intensivists, as we get called to see patients in the hospital who may be struggling and may be more sick than when they initially were admitted, and who may need the services of a critical care environment. We've certainly noticed that when we have conversations with patients and their families, we obviously inevitably have to get to treatment preferences around resuscitation and values and goals of care. And these conversations are really hard at the best of times, but they're incredibly difficult when someone is in a crisis, because of course, it's almost impossible to have a meaningful and introspective conversation with someone who's, say, struggling to breathe or may not be conscious and their family's concerned about their life. So we decided to create a tool that would facilitate these conversations very early on in the course of someone's hospitalization, hopefully before a crisis were to occur, so that we could spend the appropriate amount of time with families and their substitute decision makers, trying to elicit people's values and goals for their own care, their treatment preferences for resuscitation, and also conveying to them what we thought was medically reasonable interventions to use should their condition warrant. So we did that a pilot study, which means we did a small study in a limited number of people to just try and see whether the tool itself was feasible to implement, whether it resonated with the patients and substitute decision makers that used it, whether it resulted in any kinds of changes in people's decisions or preferences around not only resuscitation, but also allowing them to think about what are their true values and goals for their own care. We did that study almost 3 years ago now, published it in the Canadian Medical Association Journal. And from that study, we've now sort of devised a very large randomized controlled trial that is just about to start in the spring of this year that will end up enrolling about 1,150 patients in the study by the time it's done after about 3 years, using this tool and really trying to tease out whether this approach to having goals of care discussions with patients is meaningful and results in outcomes that are positive for patients, positive for their substitute decision makers, and then positive for the healthcare system in general.
Were you surprised by any of the outcomes with that initial pilot study when we completed it?
Yes and no. I was not surprised that when people sat down with a healthcare provider who devoted their undivided attention to them around a really important topic, that they would make better decisions for themselves. And I think that's what the study showed. I mean, about 50%, well, actually, I think about 75% of the people ended up choosing different resuscitation preferences than they had initially had indicated on admission to hospital or in previous conversations with other healthcare providers. So I wasn't surprised about that. I think what surprised me was the willingness of patients and their substitute decision makers to spend a lot of time talking around a really difficult subject when they're not feeling very well. So for example, when we looked at how much time did these conversations take, on average, they took around 50 minutes to complete, which if you think about it, think about any time someone may be in hospital, how often do they have 50 minutes to spend with a healthcare provider talking about themselves, their illness, their values and goals? I mean, it's an incredibly important topic, but usually these conversations are a minute long and done as literally someone's leaving the room. So that's the part that surprised me, is that one, it took a really long time to work through these conversations using the tool, but that there was an unbelievable willingness and acceptance of patients and their substitute decision makers to actually do it, to stick through it.
Excellent. When they made changes, did they change around the goals of care or resuscitation, or was it both?
It was interesting. So the tool has several components to it. So the first component is meant to try and help us better understand what the patient's life was like before they came into hospital. So to really get a sense of what is their quality of life like? How do they perceive the quality of their life? How do they perceive their own health? How do they perceive what they think is going to happen to them? The second component was really trying to tease out their values and goals for care. And what we mean by that is what is really important to them at the end of the day from their medical team. For example, you know, is it really important for them to say, survive as long as possible, irrespective of how much pain or suffering that might entail? Or perhaps is it really important for them to be comfortable at all times and be okay with not receiving certain kinds of life support interventions should they get more sick? So that was the second component. The third component was really to try and understand how much they understand about the current illness that brought them into hospital. So do they know what's wrong with them? Do they know what the care plan is? What expectations do they have in terms of recovery and going home? And then the fourth part was really around, hey, what happens if something goes wrong? What happens if you get more sick? Perhaps you have an unexpected turn for the worse. Then what would you like done? You know, what interventions might you have access to? And what reasonable expectations might you have between yourself and your healthcare provider that would be achievable and be aligned with your values and goals for care? So it was made up of four components, and the tool right now is the same. And really, we felt, and I think there's a consensus, at least in the ICU community, that an ideal conversation around goals of care should comprise at least these four components.
That's excellent. Can you tell us about the barriers that people that are facing life-limiting diseases or have been diagnosed with a life-limiting disease and the decision-making surrounding goals of care and resuscitation that occurs when people are declining or admitted to acute care, so hospital settings?
Sure. I mean, the one thing that's a big barrier is we don't know when the right time is to have these conversations. So of course, I'm an ICU physician and I only see people in the hospital. And so I can only have these conversations realistically when people are sick, but we don't know if there's a significant benefit to having these types of conversations before, say, someone ever gets sick enough to be admitted to hospital. So that's one barrier, is we don't know when the right time is to have these conversations. And maybe there's not one time, maybe there are multiple times that these conversations need to occur. Again, we don't know what the right time is or the frequency of conversations is. Another barrier is time, having the time to have these conversations. Clearly, as everyone hears in the news, we have a shortage of healthcare providers available just to deal with people's normal issues, let alone then to devote as much time as we did in our study to talking about values and goals of care and treatment preferences around end-of-life interventions. So time is a huge issue, human resources, obviously, to contribute that time. The other thing is that you want to do it at a time, for sure, when the patient hopefully can make decisions for themselves, but is also present or in the presence of their substitute decision maker. At the end of the day, by the time someone gets critically ill and may need to come to the ICU, about 75% of patients no longer have the capacity or the competency to make decisions for themselves. So if we have these conversations with the substitute decision maker present, then everybody knows what the sort of end goals are. Everybody knows what the treatment preferences are. And then there's no residual sort of angst that the substitute decision maker may have when they're making decisions without having unequivocal clarity about what the patient would have wanted for themselves. I think those are the three biggest barriers. The tool itself it can be construed also as an educational tool. So, you know, as we go through medical school and we go through our residencies, we never are really exposed or taught about how to have these conversations. I mean, they're difficult conversations to have, but there's not an accepted, established, systematic approach that's taught. And so everybody does these conversations differently, depending on their comfort, depending on their experience, and depending on their background knowledge and expertise. And intensivists obviously deal with life-limiting, you know, illnesses all the time. And so we have these conversations all the time. So we clearly are likely more comfortable. We obviously have a larger experiential base from which to draw from when we have conversations. And I like to think that our background knowledge about prognosis is a little bit better, perhaps, than someone who doesn't deal with patients who have life-threatening illnesses. So, you know, the tool is really meant to help facilitate that conversation, perhaps with a healthcare provider who isn't as confident and who doesn't have that experiential or expert knowledge.
Julia, why do you think there is so much conflict and discordance surrounding these conversations about goals of care and resuscitation? And I separate the two because they really are kind of two different conversations in my mind.
Yeah, I think so too. I mean, I think they're two important components of a larger conversation, and they naturally flow from one to the other. In fact, one informs the other. I don't think you can have a conversation about resuscitation preferences if you don't understand what the patient's values and goals of care are. I mean, it's easy as an intensivist, if I have a conversation around values and goals of care, if someone tells me, you know, Julio, I'm really interested in comfort. Yes, I want to receive treatments, but I don't want to suffer at all, right? I don't want anything where I'm suffering and perhaps my family's suffering. That really helps inform me when I have conversations around, say, resuscitation preferences. Well, then I probably wouldn't offer, or I wouldn't suggest or recommend, for example, that we use invasive mechanical ventilation should you have a problem breathing or a problem with your level of alertness that you can't breathe effectively, because I know being placed on a ventilator is associated with lots of suffering and discomfort. So it's easier to have these conversations and to justify recommendations, medical recommendations, when you know when someone's values and goals of care are.
Julio, do you feel that patients understand the complexity of their disease process? So for instance, if someone has been diagnosed with COPD or congestive heart failure or renal failure, do they understand the complexity of their disease and what types of goals of care will be beneficial to them based on their values?
Personally, I don't think so. And I think part of the problem is we don't have a very health literate society. That's more of a systemic issue. You know, if you think about, for example, high school students, so I started a high school co-op program because I felt that there was a gap in high school students' understanding of healthcare education and research. You know, if you think of how much healthcare defines us as Canadians, how much it pervades our society, how much money we spend on healthcare, it's shocking that at no point in the educational system do we ever teach students about healthcare, or do we ever make sure that students are healthcare literate? So therefore, we're not going to have a healthcare literate population. And that's a huge problem. It's a huge systemic problem that we really need to deal with early on. Clearly, that's not going to change in a day. But the question becomes is how do you have these incredibly complex conversations where on the one hand, you may not have a health literate population? And I'm not saying that to be offensive, and I don't mean that to be derogatory. You can have incredibly, you know, intelligent, well-read people who are health illiterate. Health literacy is different than other kinds of literacy. You have on the one hand a population that mostly is health illiterate, and on the other hand, you have another population that mostly speaks in medical jargon, okay? In other words, they don't really know, healthcare providers don't really know how to translate the language that they speak into a language that's understandable by a health illiterate population. And there's a natural divide in terms of communicating complex medical issues. And so you may think as a healthcare provider that you've done a fantastic job of communicating, you know, what your illness is, how we plan to treat it, what reasonable expectations you have. And then the person on the other hand, you know, I'll go talk to them, they'll say, and I'll have a conversation, and they'll say to me, why hasn't anyone ever told me something like this before? And I can almost guarantee that they've had many conversations about the same topics that I just finished talking about, but they've had it in a way where their understanding of each other is compromised because the language they're speaking is not appropriate. It's not aligned with a population that is not health literate.
In my experience, I have witnessed many goals of care and resuscitation discussions with patients and families that were quite shocking to me, as I have sat on numerous of these conversations over my career in the ICU. What do you say, think are some of the common communication errors that healthcare providers do unintentionally when talking to patients and families? Or are there any errors?
For sure. Well, I don't know that they're errors. I think it's just the way we think about and how we're taught about delivering healthcare interventions. So healthcare providers are used to always doing something. They have this default position that they want to always do something. They always want to be reactive, thinking that doing something is always the best plan of care, as opposed to perhaps not doing something, withholding a therapy, which may be a much more reasonable and much more aligned treatment approach for that patient's values and goals. So part of the problem, and many times around these resuscitative conversations, we're always talking about what options are available, what recommendations we would make around these options. And sometimes those recommendations are that we actually don't use some of these resuscitative treatments and the reasons why. And it's really hard for healthcare providers to wrap their head around not offering what they feel is offering a therapy to someone, even if that therapy not only may not be beneficial, but possibly could be harmful. So healthcare providers always err on the side of always doing something, which means that we do a lot of what we call low value care. Low value care meaning that it has little chance of providing a benefit to the patient and in fact may cause harm. And also it sort of takes healthcare resources, which are limited, and really doesn't maximize the bang for the buck from those healthcare resources. So that's one of the problems. The second problem is whenever there's a disagreement, okay? And when I use the word disagreement, I think it's more of a lack of understanding as opposed to disagreement. I mean, I've been involved in lots of conversations where I've made recommendations and either the patient or the family or the substitute decision maker don't agree with what I've recommended. And, you know, when it comes to those kinds of situations, they can be very uncomfortable. And again, it's a lot easier for a healthcare provider just then to sort of withdraw or retreat back to that default position where they say, well, you know what, I'm just going to do everything because I don't want to be involved in this disagreement. It's very uncomfortable to me. And so the default position is I want to sort of, you know, extinguish this discomfort I feel and just do something that while I know it may not be the best thing for the patient, may not be in their best interest. In fact, it may offer no benefit, but I'll feel better about it. And that's a really hard feeling to have and ignore, or at least not drive you to take the path of least resistance.
Do you feel that healthcare providers, because we don't have a lot of education in, you know, nursing school, in medical school, other professionals like respiratory therapy about having these critical conversations, is there a way that we can start to educate people so that these conversations are robust and really focusing on supporting patients for decision making?
Yeah, I do think a lot of the professional healthcare programs are starting to recognize the importance of, you know, communication in general, but specifically difficult conversations. So I do think there are resources and programs that are in place now that weren't certainly when I trained, that are trying to train the new generation of healthcare providers to be better communicators. You know, one of the things that I think is critical is having mentors who are really good at having these conversations and engaging them, learning from them, following them around, observing them, so that you can learn and have this experiential, you know, base from which you can draw from when it comes time for you to have these conversations. Like you, Sherry, I've been part of, not as an independent provider, but as a medical student, as a medical resident, as an ICU fellow, I've been part of many conversations in which I was an observer, listening to conversations. And I've heard the entire spectrum from conversations that I know I would never, ever, ever want to be part of or use to inform my own conversations, to conversations where I thought were so unbelievable and excellent that I, you know, planted them in my brain and draw on them frequently to guide my own conversation. So mentorship is a huge and important tool that we need to have in at least our hospital systems. That's the system I work in, where people can actually develop this experiential base from which they can draw from their own. And we hope that the tool that we're using and the approach that we're using won't just be restricted to ICU staff, but in fact will spread out, diffuse across the hospital so that everybody can see how we have these conversations, can learn how we use this tool, learn how to actually have those conversations themselves, so that, you know, we're not so much, and I don't even mean by we, the ICU program isn't really taking on this burden for the entire hospital, but rather these conversations are happening naturally as part of a hospitalization for every patient who comes into the hospital. To me, I think we have to make that commitment that this conversation done in a well, respectful, systematic way should be occurring with every patient who comes in the hospital. It's to me just as important as rounding on a patient. It's just as important in ensuring we give them the right medications. It's just as important that we, you know, we care about patients, we show how much we care about them. I think it's an important component of everyone's care. We just have not made the commitment to doing it regularly and systematically.
Can you think of a common communication error that occurs frequently with the healthcare team when discussing goals of care and resuscitation?
For sure, the biggest one is the do you want everything question. The do you want everything question is ubiquitous. It is a question that unfortunately is used far too often by far too many healthcare providers to try and elicit what I'm assuming are resuscitative preferences from people. I don't know. But it is a dangerous question to ask. We did a study on it and published on a study looking at what impact does asking that question have on decisions that a substitute decision maker might make around resuscitative preferences if they didn't really know what the patient wanted. And it caused a lot of angst and anxiety and doubt and had was associated with lots of residual negative feelings around decisions that were made. And part of the problem with that question is, number one, is there is no such thing as everything treatment. If you look in a medical or a surgical textbook, you will not find a treatment called everything. There's no such thing. So if you say to someone, do you want, quote, everything done? You're asking them to answer a question for which an answer doesn't exist. So that's number one. We all know that when we're asking that question, the patient perceives it as, well, of course, I mean, I have pneumonia, and if I need an antibiotic, of course I want to get an antibiotic. And if an antibiotic is included in everything, then I want everything done, right? But does that really mean that if they had a cardiac arrest, you know, that they would want to have attempts at resuscitation with chest compressions, be put on a ventilator, et cetera? Who knows? Answering that question, yes or no, doesn't tell us anything about really what the patient wants or what their values and goals of care are. So that question is a dangerous one. And, you know, in my mind, it should be banned. No one should ever be allowed to speak that question ever, either at an advanced care planning conversation that happens outside the hospital or in a hospital.
I'm going to ask you a couple questions about resuscitation. and CPR. In my experience, I feel that patients and families do not fully understand the complexity of resuscitation. And there's lots of, I've witnessed lots of conversations that talk about, you know, ramming a tube down someone's throat, breaking their ribs. But we tend to not talk about the important things such as outcomes, anoxic brain injury, profound disability. What changes can we as a healthcare team do to have those meaningful resuscitation conversations that are based on outcomes?
Again, I think it goes back to understanding the patient's values and goals for themselves, right? So it's easier to have a conversation about what recommendations you might make around resuscitation if you knew that patient well, if you knew what they wanted for themselves. You're right. The outcomes from in-hospital resuscitation, so, you know, whether someone, let's say, has a cardiac arrest outside the hospital is one thing, but in-hospital cardiac arrests have even worse outcomes than out-of-hospital cardiac arrests, which would seem counterintuitive to people. They would think, well, why should that be? I mean, you're in a hospital. If you have an arrest in a hospital, why wouldn't your chances of leaving the hospital intact be higher than, say, if you had a cardiac arrest while walking your dog and no one was around? And the reason for that is that when you're in a hospital and already ill, if you are so ill that then you go on to have a cardiac arrest, it's very rarely that your heart is the problem. It's likely that your body's being overwhelmed by this illness. And so if you have an illness that's not related to your heart, attempting to focus a resuscitation around restarting a heart that is a secondary problem makes no sense. It's not going to change the driving problem, which is this other illness, which is why outcomes for in-hospital cardiac arrests are so bad, because they have nothing to do with heart problems. They usually have to do with other problems. If you understand what someone's values and goals of care are, then when you're talking about outcomes around resuscitation, you can show how your recommendations are aligned with their values and goals. And so so it's easier for a patient and their family to understand why you may be suggesting that we don't offer, say, chest compressions, or we don't offer invasive mechanical ventilation. It helps round that circle, right? It just makes it much more sensible, as opposed to trying to say, tell people what the acute complications might be from an attempted resuscitation, which, you know, when you think about it, you know, how does that really align with their values and goals of care? So, you know, talking about short-term complications in resuscitative attempts is never sensible to me. It's just emblematic of a bigger problem, which is you don't really know the patient. You don't really know their values and goals of care. And therefore, you're just focusing on the things you do know, which is the potential acute complications of what you were potentially recommending to do to them in the event, let's say, that they had a cardiac arrest.
When we began the initial research project, I recall you using the tool with the ICU staff and talking about prognostication and outcomes. And are we good at prognosticating outcomes?
No, we're very bad at it. You know, even in ICU, physicians are very bad at it. And I can say personally, I'd like to think that I'm reasonable at it after 25 years of being in critical care, but I'm wrong so often that I know that the human body is a wondrous thing. And there is lots of biological variation that happens around illnesses, even when people are critically ill. And so when we start to prognosticate very frequently, you know, our guesses have lots of variation around them. And sometimes we're right, and sometimes we're wrong, and sometimes we're in between. The tool itself does use validated scoring, validated prognostic systems to look at outcomes for common illnesses that result in hospitalization, and also outcomes from attempted resuscitation and cardiac arrest. But what we do with the tool is we try to help people understand that there's a range of outcomes that a person can expect. And the tool is meant to try and help focus on not only what are reasonable expectations, but that there is variability around those expectations. So it introduces the uncertainty naturally in the conversation, as opposed to, you know, someone who might be having a conversation with a patient who is much more confident in their prognosis than they might otherwise be, or maybe has no confidence in prognosis, but they should have more if they were a little bit more knowledgeable or had a better experiential base. So the tool really helps in that way, because it unburdens the healthcare provider who may not be as familiar or may not have had as much experience or doesn't have as much knowledge around outcomes associated with specific illnesses or even specific, you know, life-threatening illnesses. And so that information is there for both the healthcare provider and the patient and the substitute decision maker to see. And it's really helpful because it's a visual display of this prognostic information along with the uncertainty around it.
I'll switch to end of life and death and dying. And as you and I know, death in the ICU is very different than death that occurs in other places, such as up on the floor in a hospital, a medical floor, or in hospice or at a patient's home or long-term care. How is death different in the intensive care unit?
Well, first, let's look at the environment. I mean, the intensive care unit is not a hospitable environment. It is noisy. It is loud. It is always daytime because the lights are always on. It's always distracted because there's always some urgent or emergent problem going on. So very difficult to, say, focus on a specific problem. There's lots of changeover of staff. So you're always seeing different people every day. So there's a bit of a, while there's some continuity of care, there's not as much continuity of care as there might be in those other environments. So right off the hop, it's not the greatest place to experience death. On top of that, a lot of people who die in the ICU, their course is such that they're unconscious most of the time. They may not even realize that they're dying. They may not have had time to have had closure with their family because, you know, people set up false expectations about maybe their recovery. And so very frequently, it's a time in which there's a lot of sorrow and regret that people didn't get a chance to say or do what they wanted to do, because now the patient is comatose and they're going to die comatose. The other thing is that there's lots of conversations around death in the ICU that have to do with withdrawal of care. So it's very hard to die on a ventilator, no matter how sick you are. Ventilators are incredible machines and they can keep even the most sick people alive. And we have a lot of interventions that can do that. So death inevitably in the ICU almost always involves stopping or withdrawing care. And lots of those decisions, because a lot of these goals of care conversations didn't occur, are really problematic, not only for the substitute decision maker, but lots of times for families. One, because they're unsure if it's the right thing to do. But two, lots of times there's lots of conflict in and amongst families who may disagree on the best sort of approach to the person's care, that is to continue care or withdraw care. So for me, I mean, while we've had good deaths, if you can call it that, in the ICU, there are as many bad deaths, or maybe more bad deaths, because of all of these issues.
Is there any outcomes for families that have experienced a withdrawal of life support in the ICU? And I'm talking about grief and bereavement.
Sorry, so do you mean, do we have support systems for families?
Well, that, and what happens to these families after they've experienced a withdrawal of life support? Do they have complicated grief or post-traumatic stress disorder?
Yeah, so there's lots of literature around what happens to people left behind after someone dies in an intensive care unit. And especially when that patient's values and goals for their own care were unknown, which, as you pointed out at the beginning of this podcast, happens much more frequently than it should. Those people have to make incredibly difficult decisions, and specifically around the withdrawal or limitations of care. And they frequently have lots of guilt or anger or sorrow around those decisions. Many of them, as you say, have post-traumatic stress disorder. They have really complicated grief syndromes that happen and persist for long periods of time. Many families, honestly, they break apart because they have so much conflict during those final phases of a person's life, in which we've seen families that, you know, say no longer talk to one another because that period of time was so difficult that it strained all kinds of relationships that may have already been strained, may not have been the most robust relationships, but it was the final blow to severing the ties that they had that kept them together. So it's one of those situations we are trying with this approach to goals of care to also try to eliminate those sort of periods post-death where the people who are left behind are also suffering. We do have some systems in place. Obviously, we have our social workers, we have our staff, we have our chaplaincy that can come in and chat with families and provide support. But we don't really have a system in place, at least in our ICU program, and I don't think in many ICU programs, where we reconnect with all of the families and substitute decision makers to see if they're doing okay, to see if there's a way for us to help them through the grief, to help maybe explain things that happened that were not so clear at the time that they were happening.
I'll just move to the healthcare team that is providing end of life and withdrawal of life support, and often providing treatment that they may see as futile. What happens to these healthcare professionals?
So, I mean, the most obvious thing is whenever there's some kind of disagreement between the care we are providing and perhaps the care we think we ought to be providing or not providing, it causes grief on both sides. But from the healthcare perspective, from the healthcare provider perspective, it's certainly associated with burnout. I mean, if you're spending, you know, days and days and days looking after a patient who you believe will not benefit from any of the interventions and many of the interventions you're delivering, I think it's inevitable that you become disengaged from that patient and the family. I think it's inevitable that if you do that enough times, you do suffer burnout because you feel like you're simply there going through the motions, delivering care that might be considered medically non-beneficial. And yet the family is insisting that we continue on, despite what might be apparent suffering and pain and distress in the patient that the family might ignore, but that you as a healthcare provider obviously can't ignore. And it becomes incredibly distressful that you're essentially being forced to participate in delivering treatments that not only do you feel add no value, but may in fact be causing harm or distress or suffering to the patient.
Julio, you've had lots of intensive care experience over the years. Do you have an idea of how to build resilience in our healthcare teams? How do we support people that are having these very complex conversations, not just in the ICU, but across the board, in palliative care as well? You know, that constant exposure to human suffering can have an effect on you. And you know, when I first graduated, there was no such thing as self-care. We did not debrief, and you certainly did not show that you were affected emotionally by the things that you were seeing and doing. That just was not an acceptable as an intensive care nurse. Now, over the years, I've seen it evolve, but I do think there's room for us to support our healthcare teams in a different way and build that resiliency and help people not burn out if we can.
Yeah, I mean, resiliency is a very difficult term for me because I'm not sure that there's such a thing as building resiliency. And I always worry about using that term because I always feel like, well, if you're not a resilient person, if you really suffer and sometimes suffer in silence, does that mean there's something wrong with you? I think there has to be a system level change to ensure that we support all healthcare providers in the jobs that they do. I know as a person, I've been fundamentally changed by the things that I've seen. I'm not the person I was, 25 years ago. I know that for a fact. I think it's human nature to develop tolerance to things that are very unpleasant. I think it's just one of the defense mechanisms, and maybe it's one of the resiliency mechanisms that we have. Having said that, tolerance is not a great strategy, as you say, Sherry, to have a stiff upper lip and just, move forward and move on. We do have much better support systems in place for healthcare providers, whether they're debriefing sessions, whether they're counseling sessions, whether it's just, a very good team that always works together, that supports one another, which I think is the best resiliency system. I think we have an inherent resiliency system in environments like the ICU because we're very much like a family. And you know this, Sherry, is that you get to know people in a way, the people you work with, it becomes your second home. These are like family, extended family members. And it is really those relationships, at least for me, that have sustained me when I've encountered, cases that were difficult or distressful. I must admit, I've never sought external sort of support or help. Not sure if that has been a good decision or not, but I found always what I needed in the team. And I'm not saying it's the right solution for everybody, but I think it's an important one. And it's what sustains us. So if you work in an ICU in which there isn't that type of cohesive unit, I just don't know how you make it through a day. I really don't. You would need to have many other external support systems in place to help you just come back to your job and help you cope with what you see. We just have to care about each other more. We have to work in environments where if you're asking healthcare providers to provide a certain level of care for their patients, that organization has to ensure that you at least care as much about the healthcare provider as you do about the patient. I don't think you can work in organizations in which, not that there's a disdain, but that there's a lack of caring for the employees in that organization. And then you have an expectation that they're going to just be able to do their job and care about things. I think you have to treat people the way you want those people to treat others. And that's an important systemic issue that organizations need to deal with.
Excellent. I 100% agree. Is it okay if I ask you a question about COVID and the intensive care unit team? I know this has been a very challenging time for ICU staff, not just emotionally, but physically. And is there anything that you'd like to share about how COVID has impacted the ICU team?
I think the one thing that COVID did a couple things. On the positive side, if you were not a cohesive team before COVID, the ICU system would have fallen apart. So I think it reinforced to me how important our team is, how important we are to each other and how much we care about each other, because I think that's certainly what sustained us through COVID as we were being overwhelmed by the number of cases and expectations. On the negative side, it really, I think, stretched our capacity as people, as healthcare providers, and as organizations, to really provide the level of care that we were accustomed to providing to patients in a non-pandemic environment. In other words, we tried to do the best we could do, recognizing that our ability to do everything we wanted to do for everyone was limited because our resources, both human and otherwise, were so stretched. I think it also hastened a lot of decisions that people had about retiring. I noticed that, you know, after the last real wave of COVID, a lot of the nurses who were around, you know, kind of retirement period, who had talked about it in passing, but not seriously, I think, you know, made the decision that that was it, that they were finally going to retire. And, you know, they held on to support the team because they knew retiring in the midst of that pandemic would have been a disaster. But shortly after, you know, let's say the last wave ended and they felt like the team could manage, many of them left the ICU. And it was one of those things, I think, that it shortened the working life of everybody who was in the ICU, including myself.
Thank you for doing such important work, Julio. And back to our research study, what do you see in the future after this piece of this research project? Because I'm assuming that there will be subsequent, more robust studies done afterwards using this tool, perhaps in the community or in other areas. And I'm talking about, you know, dialysis units and patients with COPD and congestive heart failure. If we can start utilizing this tool, maybe developing some of that knowledge about advanced care planning and disease process for patients and families, do you see it moving outside the walls of the hospital, I guess is what my question is.
Well, I mean, assuming that we see a positive impact with the tool in this study, and I mean, who knows, we don't know if we will, but we hope that we do. We certainly have built the tool with the foresight of implementing it potentially in other areas outside of a hospital-based system, be they in family practice units, ideally where I think they should be, but as you say, in other environments like dialysis units, et cetera. You know, even if the tool isn't used exactly as it is in its current form, but there's some kind of approach that resembles the approach that we're suggesting works, I think that would be a really positive thing. The one part of the tool that I think is really innovative and I think can be implemented in many different environments is this alignment with the elicitation of the values and goals of care, and then the recommendations around especially life-sustaining therapies. We have a very innovative and novel approach to try and align these things so that these conversations become much more straightforward, understandable, repeatable and reproducible, and comfortable. And we hope that that part of the tool is used consistently across many different environments. And I think if it is, even if we're not using the other parts of the tool, like the prognostication scores, I still think that part of the tool will have served its purpose very well.
I'm going to end by questioning now. I suspect there might be some questions. We're sort of getting to the end of the hour, surprisingly. Or unsurprisingly to me, we could talk about this for hours. I want to thank you, though, in advance, Julio, for all of your incredible work that you've done over the years while I've been able to work with you in the intensive care unit, in the critical care outreach team, and all of the incredible programs that you have been involved at Ground Roots and developing cohesive teams and utilizing education and, you know, your stats and your evidence-based medicine, which is very, very helpful and I think so beneficial to our patients and families. So that I would really like to thank you for that. And thank you for being part of our podcast here today. I suspect that listeners will now think about advanced care planning in a different way, and we'll start to have some conversations with their healthcare providers, and most importantly, with their substitute decision makers and their families.
Yeah,
I'm not sure if there's any questions that are in the panel or...
Hi, it's Linda. I just want to say thank you as well. That was absolutely phenomenal interview, Sherry. And thank you, Julio, for your expertise. I can just say on behalf of the network, advanced care planning is one of our, huge interests. And at any point in time, we would absolutely love to see some sort of tool come out into the community to help educate our colleagues on for these difficult conversations. And as you said, it wouldn't have to be the whole tool, it could be part of the tool. As an education facilitator, I can tell you that we get many requests for education on difficult conversations. So that would be something that would be phenomenal to work with. Does anyone else have any other questions for Julio?
Hi, Linda, it's Rachel. I don't have any ends, but I just wanted to highlight a few things as I was listening because there was such a robust amount of information that was shared. I took a few notes. I just want to say so well done, Sherry. Amazing questions to highlight some of the key issues. And I just wanted to say the conversation absolutely flowed between both of you. And I had so many aha moments as I was listening. The theme on healthcare literacy, you know, separate from advanced care planning, but important to have when you're engaging in those conversations, you know, that really brought to the forefront and the explanation how it's different from other definitions of literacy. I personally, as I assume others do as well, tend to equate both in the same, and they are so very different. So I appreciate the definition and the explanation and some of the tidbits as to how we can impact that by having a focus on our young folk in the communities. So how we can make some differences going forward in the future. The question that still continues to be used by healthcare providers and even informal care providers when they're trying to elicit values and beliefs conversations from their loved one or from someone that they're working with who has a life-limiting illness. That question that you said, do you want everything done? I think that was so important to hear and the rationale as to why that's truly an oxymoron. I think so much information was shared, Dr. Didio-Jato, that made us come away as listeners reflecting on both our own practice, and I expect others will do the same. I like the fact that the themes on grief, resilience, and how we can improve that and what we do well are so important. And I enjoyed the fact that we spoke a little bit about the cohesiveness of a team as being so important for job satisfaction and for coping, and that organizational support is also such an essential component for excellence in care and service provision for patients and families. I concur what Linda just said. Such a phenomenal presentation, and I thank you for being present. Well done, Sherry.
So, Julio, is there anything that you want to add as we conclude our podcast today? Any words of wisdom or something from the heart? I know you have one.
I just want to thank you once again for the invitation and the great questions. And it's always good to think about these things because we get so busy in a daytime and sometimes we forget the things that are really important. And you made me think about a lot of things. When I saw the list of questions, I thought, oh, this is going to be like a really deep conversation. And I may not have had one in a while. So thank you, Sherry, for giving me the opportunity after my week of on call with lots of difficult cases to get in the weeds with you about these really deep and important matters.
Perhaps you haven't had those conversations because I've been away for a year.
I know.
I do miss my team. I have a new family now that has embraced me. So I'm a very blessed nurse and healthcare provider because I've had the pleasure of working with incredible ICU team, which truly was my family, my second family. And now I've, you know, been adopted by a new family. So there's so much more work to do. And I hope that my goal is to help support ICU as well. You do incredible work and incredibly difficult work. So I hope that, you know, as a network, a palliative care network, that we can still work cohesively together and start trying some new innovative ways of doing the really important work that we do.
Absolutely.
So thank you so much, Julio. It's been a pleasure as always.
Same.
Yes. Thank you so much, Sherry. And thank you so much, Dr. Diodato.